Sylvia and me.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hi, I'm Patricia Walsh Chadwick, the author of Little Sister, a memoir. Welcome to Sylvia and Me.
Patricia, thank you so much for coming today. It's great meeting you. So, Little Sister, where should we begin? I know that it's a memoir, and it's more of a story of love. And it's your story. So what made you, you know, everyone has a story and they want to write a memoir and everyone's writing them. Yours is a little bit different. What was the impetus for you even thinking of writing this book and undertaking this process?
Well, I was certainly not young when I undertook the process. It was my 55th birthday, and I was sitting with my parents, looking out over the ocean. And I turned to them and said, when I look back on my childhood, I actually look back with a lot of happiness. And I said, I'm thinking of recording the stories from my childhood. And I knew I had to lay that in front of them because this story is perhaps a reader might think anything but happy. And both of my parents were so supportive. And they said, we think that's great. So for me, the door was opened. I had now shared with them the fact that I wanted to do it. And the impetus for wanting to do it was here I was at the age of 55. The youngest child that had grown up in this situation was about 48. And I realized that in 50 years, in half a century, none of us would be alive. And I thought a firsthand story is better than second or third hand.
Okay, you just mentioned, you just said, none of us would be alive who had been in this situation. What do you mean by situation?
So I was one of 39 children and about 60 adults who lived a communal life. And this took place from the late 1940s till the late 1960s or early 1970s. And the 39 children were born to 12 couples who lived within this community. And there were an array of single men and women. And the community came together under very Roman Catholic auspices. It had started as a club for young men and women at Harvard and Radcliffe. And by the late 1940s, the two leaders, a Jesuit priest named Leonard Feeney and a Catholic laywoman named Catherine Clark, had kind of morphed this club of sorts, Catholic club, into a very doctrinaire organization that really spewed a lot of venom at anyone who was not Catholic. And they held to a dogma of the church that said, outside the Catholic Church, there is no salvation. And my parents, my father, in the late 40s, he was about 30 years old. He had just come through the war as a lieutenant. And he met my mother, who was all of 18, when she came to this club, this Catholic club, and they got married. And my father was teaching at Boston College while he was getting his graduate degree. And he and my mother, as well as an array of other young men and women, followed Leonard Feeney and his declaration of this dogma. And when the cardinal, who was the archbishop at the time, Archbishop Cushing, a name that I think many people might be familiar with.
I think so.
He pushed back on the organization. And ultimately, the organization was excommunicated from the Catholic Church. And we were then a group of about 60 adults and a few children who over the course of 5 or 6 years turned into 39 children with these 12 married couples. And there we were, a little enclave of 100 people, professing the Catholic dogma in a way that very few other Catholics were doing it. And we segregated ourselves from the world completely.
Well, I'm going to mention six characteristics, and I think maybe you'll figure out what their characteristics of. Authoritarian leadership, the acceptance of an authority figure who exercises excessive control. Exclusivism, they see themselves the single means of salvation on earth. Isolationism, opposition to independent thinking. Fear of being disfellowshipped, and threats of satanic attack, use of fear, intimidation to keep members in line. What are those characteristics of?
They are the characteristics of a cult.
And this little community of about 100 grown-ups and 39 children, what kind of community was that that you were essentially living in?
Well, it took me a long time to understand and accept the fact that it really was a cult. I wrote the entire book never using the word cult. I never thought of it as a cult, even though I was writing it in my 60s. I would say I was certainly intellectual enough to be able to see a cult in other regimes. I certainly thought of that in the case of the Branch Davidians or Jim Jones. But my own daughter, when she was in college, is the one that had to tell it to me. I just never thought of it as a cult because it was my home.
Okay. So you talked about the fact that Cardinal Cushing was not accepting of this little community. Father Feeney and then essentially Sister Clark, Catherine Clark, split off and you have this community. How did this, you know, how did it morph? You were living with your parents.
I was. And I have a wonderful, wonderful memory growing up. And my earliest memories are truly the sounds of laughter, because I was one of only four or five children at that time before all the others came along. And I was in this environment where there were 60 adults around me all the time. And I knew nothing better. I lived with my parents in a house, but every single day, three meals a day, the 60 adults gathered with the families. We had mass, but we had to say it secretly. Father Feeney said it secretly because we had been ostracized by the Catholic Church. Okay. But the environment was one that was amazingly stimulating to me. And there was a lot of laughter. And over the next few years, I observed as all of the grown-ups went from wearing pretty colored dresses and high-heeled shoes with open toes and things like that to all of a sudden all dressing in black skirts with white blouses and black jackets. And before long, they were all changing their names. My mother was known as Betsy, and my dad was known as Jim. And pretty soon, they became Brother James Aloysius and Sister Elizabeth Ann. And after that happened, when I was about four, I was not even allowed to call them Mummy and Daddy anymore.
That must have been so. Did you? You were only four, but you sound like you were a very precocious little girl. Did you question, or was it such an environment where you just didn't question rules that were made?
The leadership was obviously Father Feeney and Catherine Clark, who ultimately became Sister Catherine. And I knew that I couldn't challenge them. That being said, as long as I was living with my parents, and little by little, over the next few years, we ended up being seven, my parents, and there were five, I have four younger siblings. As long as we were able to live together, nothing else troubled me.
But that changed, didn't it?
When I was 6 years old, it changed. And a couple of months after my sixth birthday, just one day out of the blue, we were told that if we were 3 years old or older, so I was six at the time, my sister Kathy was four, and my brother David was three. And then we had two other little siblings who were like two, and one was just an infant. She was born a few months earlier. And we were told that those of us that were three and older were no longer going to live with our parents, but we were going to live dormitory style, the girls on one floor and the boys on another. And in a second, truly, overnight, the apartment floor that was my parents' floor, the house where I lived, was stripped of all of my parents' belongings. They were put into another house. And I went up that night, and suddenly, for the first time in my life, I was no longer sleeping in the same bedroom with my own sister. And there were eight of us living on that floor without any parents around at all.
And we talked about, I mentioned isolation. It wasn't just that now you weren't living with your parents, but from what I understand, they started building a stockade fence around the houses. So really blocking out the rest of the world, because before that, did you ever go off campus or whatever you want to call the, you know, outside the little community?
Well, as a young child, one of these grown-ups always had me by the hand. And there we were living in Cambridge, and the Charles River is that beautiful river that divides Cambridge from Boston. And I would go down for endless hours and pick buttercups or daisies or, you know, watch the ducks in the river. And you're right. We had bought these seven houses, or let's say Catherine Clark had procured these seven houses. My parents had ended up selling their three-family house that they bought on the GI Bill, and they just gave the proceeds to what we called the Center. St. Benedict Center became just known as the Center. And so all of a sudden, all of these adults, 60 adults, were totally sharing in one financial pool. And they built this fence, and suddenly the entire world was shut out. There used to be the rag man that would come down the street. There was the guy selling fruit on his little wagon. And all of that just disappeared. We were no longer allowed to go outside of the fence.
And no one questioned. They started getting used to this because, as you said, your father was a very well-educated man.
You are right. When the adults, shortly after I was born, formed this organization, and they formed, in essence, a religious order that they called the Slaves of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. And when they did that, they promised obedience to Father Leonard Feeney. And I think that that was a vow that they took seriously. And so for the next 20 years, it guided them.
They even, Father Feeney, shortly after separating everyone, ordered the parents into taking vows of celibacy.
He did, and my parents talked to me about that at one point. As I was, many years later, as I was actually celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary, they had left by then, and they told me that Father Feeney pressured them, and my father said, absolutely not, we are not going to do that. And he came back, and he came back, and he eventually told my parents, there were 12 married couples, and he told my parents that they were the only couple that was holding out. Well, I came to find out later that other couples told their children that Father Feeney used the same tactic with them. And so he basically coerced people to forego one of the sacraments, which is the sacrament of marriage in the Catholic Church, to take a vow of celibacy, which was not the life they were called to.
And then not only were you separated and not living with your parents, but sometime in the late 50s, like 1958, you were no longer allowed, the children were no longer allowed to even speak to their parents except very rarely. I think you called it community meetings.
In 1958, so I was 9 years old at that time, we moved from Cambridge to this little town called Harvard. And within Harvard, there was this little hamlet that was known as Still River. This was agricultural country. This was Yankee country. There were no Catholics out there. I shouldn't say none. There was a Catholic church. But these were mostly Yankee Unitarians. And Sister Catherine, in essence, was the mastermind. And once we moved out to Still River, she totally superseded Father Feeney in terms of control, in terms of rulemaking. And we weren't there but a week or two when she came into our refectories, and we had four refectories. The grown men, who were known as big brothers, were in one. The grown women, who were called big sisters, were in another. And then there were the children's refectories. The little girls were called little sisters, and the boys little brothers. And little sister is the title of the books, hence the title. And Sister Catherine came in, and I distinctly remember her words. And she said, "Little ones, your lovely big brothers and sisters would like to spend more time praying and more time thinking about God. And so you are no longer going to talk to them. We'll have time, special times when you can get together and talk to them. But during the day, every day, you're no longer allowed to talk to them." And I could not believe what I was hearing. At least, even though I was not living with my parents, anytime I saw them, I could say hello. And every evening we would get together and have recreation. And all of a sudden, in one fell swoop, she had taken my parents away even more.
But the saving grace is your father.
At that time in my life, he was. My father did not keep the rules. And his job, and this is a very interesting part of the cultish kind of element here. My father was one of the really big intellectuals, as were a couple of other of the big brothers. When we moved to Still River, you might have thought, and we were homeschooled, we were all being taught, you might have thought he might teach mathematics, but no, he was assigned the job to repair the automobiles. And so the good thing about that was that all the repairs, and we had 7 or 8 cars, as you can imagine, we're 100 people.
Right.
And the good thing about that was that all the repair work was done right in the main driveway, which meant I would go past him 6 times every day as I went from the schoolhouse to the main house. And while we were not allowed to speak to each other, he would lift his head up as he was under the hood of a car fixing it, and he would just take his little finger and wiggle it at me. And that was his way of saying hello. And then we developed this little secret pattern that on his birthday and my birthday, and once we moved to Still River, we no longer celebrated birthdays. We only celebrated our feast days. Okay. And on our birthdays, we would secretly find a way to meet each other and just wish each other a happy birthday. And I have spoken to my siblings, needless to say, and he did the same things with them. And I think for me, that was the glue that kind of held me together through these long weeks and months when we weren't even allowed to talk to him.
And it was sometime around then that Sister Catherine, I understand she ruled with an iron hand.
Sister Catherine had set up rules, and you could argue that some of them were tyrannical. We were not being raised, obviously, by our parents, and she had hand-selected 8 women that were going to raise the 39 children. And each one was responsible for 5 children, and they were called angels. And then Sister Catherine introduced what she called the Big Punisher, which was a 2-foot-long piece of garden hose that was used as often as sometimes twice a day on a child. And the extraordinary thing was, and it is truly the fact, and I can tell you, the parents who were not angels, the parents were unaware of what was happening to their children, because this would always be done when the parents weren't around or down at the far end of the corridor where the children lived. And it was a secret that no child really told their parents because, one, they weren't allowed to talk to their parents. So it does strike me that there was a lot of manipulation in what Sister Catherine did in terms of controlling the access that the children had to their parents.
Well, the message from Father Feeney and Sister Catherine, as you said, was that they would tell you that the 39 children were the luckiest children in the world because you had been dedicated to God from your infancy. And their plan was that you would all take vows of celibacy and become nuns and monks, just like grown men and women. You were shielded from everything, television, newspapers, news, all of that was evil. But I understand you, although you didn't have access to that, you originally had been around some very intelligent people from different parts of the world. So I know that, as I said before, I called you precocious, and evidently you get that from your dad. I don't know anything about your mom, but your dad, you know, showed that he was going to take care of his children. You were a curious child.
I was. And in fact, the reading, there was reading that was presented every single evening while we all sat and had dinner. And it's an old Catholic book, and it's called The Roman Martyrology, and it probably doesn't mean too much to too many of your listeners. But the fact of the matter is, it would tell the story of the saint whose feast day it was the following day. And I didn't so much care about the saints because so many of them were martyrs, and I had no desire to be a martyr, none whatsoever.
But you were supposed to be.
I was supposed to be. But the fact of the matter is, what I loved was the places that they came from around the world. And so when one came from Tuscany, I would think to myself, I can't wait to see Tuscany in Italy. Or if one came from Cappadocia, I wanted to see Cappadocia, or it's Cairo, or Lebanon. And I built up this huge array of cities and parts of the world that I wanted to see when I was 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. And it wouldn't leave me. I was drawn to it. And eventually, when I got out, I went and visited every one of those places. But I remember even going to Assisi with my husband in the 1980s and feeling that I was swept off my feet. I had heard about St. Francis of Assisi for so long, and here I finally was in that place that I had imagined as a five-year-old.
Well, we can get on to your teenage years. And I understand you developed a series of crushes on some of the grown men, but you probably didn't even know what was going on inside you.
You know, we were not explained anything. I suppose if you are raising these children to be dedicated to God for the rest of their lives, why should they need to know about procreation, about any elements of what happens between boys and girls, you know, as they get into puberty. So I had no notion. And suddenly I found myself attracted to people and had no idea why. And it's so interesting to me now looking back, because I watched my own daughter years later develop this first little silly little crush when she was 9. And it was so evident to me that she had a crush on this boy. And then as she got older, just the things she would do. So I was obviously unaware that my simple and childish, frankly, interests could be so observed by Sister Catherine. And I would get hauled into her office and excoriated for following one of the big brothers around or something like that. And I couldn't understand, how does she know I like him? But having never been told anything, none of the girls, when they reached puberty and got their first period, were even told anything about why it happens.
Sister Catherine was so scared.
And many were scared. Many were very scared. And Sister Catherine simply told me, oh, darling, you're just more like our Blessed Mother. She had it too.
Okay, there's an explanation for you. but as you said, your crushes continued no matter, you know, how many times you were hauled into her office, her room. You were 17 and a senior in high school. What did Sister Catherine tell you at that time?
Well, she called me in, and I remember thinking to myself, what have I done wrong this time? And I walked into her office, and there was my mother in the office with her. I had never, ever been in the office, Sister Catherine's office, with my mother there. And Sister Catherine, in front of my mother, developed this very dulcet, sweet-toned voice and said, "Darling, not everyone has a vocation to become a nun." And I thought, well, where is this going? And I certainly thought, well, she's right about that. And the next thing I knew, she was describing what married life would be like as though it would be a huge burden. And I'm thinking, this isn't so bad. I like this idea. Until it came to me with horror that what she was telling me was that she was kicking me out. And that was in October of 1965. And I had just started my senior year of high school. And she told me I couldn't tell anyone. And so from October until the following June, I had to keep the secret that on the day I was graduating, I would then be gone. And I knew nobody outside of this community.
But you had been accepted already to Vassar and Bates. They had wanted you to apply, and you got accepted.
I applied for one reason alone. They needed to register our school to be certified by the state of Massachusetts. And since some of us had been already going through school for, 12 years, they decided to have some of us apply. And I applied to Vassar, which obviously would have been the creme de la creme to get accepted at. And I also applied to Bates, where my father had graduated. And I got into both. And I did this when I knew I was being kicked out. But it was still my home, and I wanted them to get the accreditation. But the moment the letters came in accepting me at both schools, she dictated a letter to me saying that I would not be coming. So suddenly that avenue for further education was closed.
So right after graduation, you were secreted away. You couldn't say goodbye to anyone. You had no idea when you were going to see your parents or your brothers and sisters again. You had no money, no advice from anyone, no skills, no nothing. What did you do?
Well, I went to a secretarial school, and admittedly, Sister Catherine paid for that. So here I was, a bright young woman that probably absolutely should have been going into college. But the fact of the matter was, I knew nothing about the outside world. The whole language of the outside world was foreign to me. I had never heard a swear word. I had never heard even a slang word. Someone passed me one day, was on the bus with me one day, and turned to me and said, "Has anyone ever told you you look like Lauren Bacall?" Oh. I had no idea who Lauren Bacall was. I didn't know if it was a compliment or not.
It was a compliment.
So I was so completely naive. I can't fathom what I might have been like as a freshman at Vassar that year. But all that being said, I then got this secretarial degree and had to go out and find a job. And the first interview I went on was at a brokerage firm in Boston. And I met the two partners, and they were just setting up a big office there, and they needed a receptionist. And I had an interview with them, and they asked me right then and there if I could start the next day. Well, I didn't dare say no. I was now on my own. I had found a small one room at the YWCA, mm-hmm. and that with a communal bath down the hall, and that was where I was living. And I accepted the job and started as the receptionist, and that was my entree into a career on Wall Street.
Which you've had for about 30 years now.
Yeah, well, I did, and then I ultimately retired from it. But yes, I then managed to claw my way up. I put myself through school, going to Boston University and Wharton at night. And ultimately, 9 years later, I got my degree, by which time I'd come to New York. And I proceeded to go through being an analyst and then a portfolio manager and a strategist and ultimately a global partner.
And you're married, you live in Greenwich, you have two children in their 20s. How has the book been received by some of the now grown-ups, of course, of the 39 brothers and sisters?
Of the children? Yes, thank you for asking that. So the book came out this past spring, a year ago. And sadly, of the 39 children, six have already died. But at least 15 of the others, and of course I have my own siblings, four of them, but in addition to that, 15 of the kids have come to me and said, thank you for writing this book. What I had not realized, and what I had not suffered from myself, at least to the degree that some of them have, was the PTSD that they suffered. Some of them have been in therapy for 10, 20, 30 years. And for them, my telling the story, even though it was only my story, and I didn't tell anyone else's story, I didn't think it was my right, they said it was a burden off their shoulders, that now the world knew. And some of them had been in a mode to cut everybody off that we had grown up together. And they said, I can't take it anymore. And now they've come back. And I think for that, I look at that as, the best benefit from having written this book.
Well, I understand that. A lot of people are so afraid to say anything for so many different reasons that it just takes one person to validate within their own lives, to give validation to what others went through.
Really, yes.
So I know you've been asked this many times, and I don't think it's boring, but I'll follow suit and ask you, what would you change if there was anything you would want to change in your life?
I have been asked that question, and I remember the first time that I was asked it, I quickly thought through where I am today. I am married for now 35 years. I have two wonderful children. I would be married to my husband all over again. I adore my children. My family, my extended family, we're all very, very tight. I've had a wonderful career. I've traveled the world. And if anywhere along that path from birth till where I am today, I said, I wish we could have changed this whole element of things. How do I know I'd be there today? How do I know I would have my family? How do I know I would have the wonderful friends? How do I know I would have the fabulous life I've had? So I can honestly say I wouldn't change a thing. That doesn't mean that
you want to relive all of it.
I would not want to have to relive it all. But both my parents, the book is dedicated to my parents, for always, as I said to them, to mother and daddy, and that's the way I refer to them, for always letting me know that they loved me. And that was important. And I did mention my father more, but my mother came through in unbelievable ways after I left. And life was very, very difficult. And both of them left. Sister Catherine died, interestingly, a couple of years after she kicked me out. And the whole place started to fall apart after that. And my parents and all my siblings left. And they had a wonderful, wonderful life after that.
So what's up next for you?
Well, I am writing another book, and we touched just briefly on the fact that I was very fortunate to become the receptionist at a brokerage firm, and that led to my career on Wall Street. I don't fathom that would have ever happened if I had necessarily come out of college. I don't even know what I might have majored in, but having started off as a receptionist and being at a brokerage firm channeled me into majoring in economics at Boston University, and I grew up on Wall Street at a time when there were hardly any women on Wall Street.
That's for sure.
And I started, of course, possibly below the bottom rung of the ladder. And I had some of the most fantastic mentors, all of whom were men. But it was a journey that was exhilarating. And I am so grateful to so many people. There were some crazy and funny things, as you can imagine. Wall Street gets a bad reputation, perhaps worse than it should. I thrived, and I am enormously grateful, and I think there's a story to be told, because sometimes when you feel there's a glass ceiling, and sometimes that glass ceiling can hit you early, I always found that life is a little pluck and a little luck, and when you seem to hit a glass ceiling, if you look around, there's a door that's opening that's helping you to move to the next level.
I so agree. Patricia, thank you so much. And for anyone who wants to learn more about Patricia, and I'm sure there are links to getting her book, Little Sister, it's patriciachadwick.com. Patricia, again, thank you so much. It's been a delight.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining me today. On our next podcast, I'll be talking to another extraordinary, inspiring woman who has made her mark on the world. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform and, of course, our website, sylviaandme.com. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button to keep up with the latest episodes. Review, rate, and take us with you wherever you are. I want to hear from you. If you know of an extraordinary, inspiring woman, please contact me at sylvia@lifeofprey.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay safe. Today's podcast has been recorded at Verso Studios at the Westport Library. This has been a Life of Prey production.